Any other questions or things we should announce? All right. So today, I'm calling this talk Stories of My Teacher. Today was our Founders Day, Founders Ceremony, if you were here for the chanting service. I have to admit that, you know, when I came up with the title for this talk a couple days ago and I sent it out by email, it feels like a little bit of false advertising, because when I sat down to really pull it together, it's like, I don't really have a good narrative memory. Ironically, Kyogen had a great narrative memory. He could tell you stories and this happened and then that happened and then that happened. To me, it all just becomes like a mush, and I have emotions associated with it. Like, I really liked that. I really felt this way, but I don't really have good stories per se, but I think to some extent, whatever I'm sharing is a narrative of sorts, right? So in a way, it's a story. So very, very briefly, I'm just going to give you an overview of, like, okay, what do we mean by a founder, and why do we do this founder ceremony, and in what sense is Kyogen our founder? Very brief overview of our lineage, because that gives us some context. And then I'll talk more about Kyogen and my teacher, Gyokuko, specifically. And if you're curious, all of this is on our website. So you can look under, you know, our temple or our community, and then there's like our story, and you can just read the history of Bright Way Zen and the history of our lineage and a little bit of biographical stuff about my teachers. So if you want to learn more, it's there. So we have a founders ceremony because Zen Buddhism is a lineage tradition. Many forms of Buddhism are, but in particular, Zen. And in that sense, we see the transmission of the Dharma, of this tradition, as being something that happens person to person. So like teacher to apprentice, and then the apprentice masters it, and then the apprentice goes on to carry it and teaches other people. So it's a very, it's like, we say warm hand to warm hand. So that there's many things that you can learn from a book, you can learn from the teachings, you can practice your meditation, but this tradition that we hold, this rich three-dimensional tradition, is something that you really have to get from other people. So we trace that lineage, and during our usual morning chanting service, we recite that lineage all the way from Shakyamuni Buddha and his students, and students in India and China and Japan and America. And some of it's a little mythological, but you know, much of it is actual historically true. So we always remind ourselves of lineage in gratitude for what we have received. And you don't have to feel a cultish devotion to all of this, but you know, it's a very basic acknowledgement that I wouldn't have been able to come up with this by myself. It wouldn't have occurred to me to be mindful while washing dishes, or like, you know, go forward and embrace my difficult emotions instead of just trying to kind of get rid of them, or to, you know, there's many, many things that it never would have occurred to me to do or find, not to mention all the other ways that Sangha relationships support us. So it's gratitude for that. And then, of course, that lineage does come through specific people. So very, really briefly, our lineage, this current generation of teachers, me and my Dharma siblings, decided to call this the Dharma Cloud lineage, because both of my teachers, Ho'un Kyogen, Ho'un Gyokuko, those are their Dharma names. Ho'un means Dharma Cloud. And Roshi Kennett gave them that name. I think that might have even been her. We call it like the Way name, kind of like the family name of her name as well. So the three of anything that comes through the three of them, we call like the Dharma Cloud lineage. And there's a good, I don't know, there's a good 10, 12 of us transmitted actively functioning teachers in this Dharma family, if you will. So it all starts, well, it doesn't start with, but we'll pick up the story with Peggy Kennett, an English woman who, as I mentioned before our service, was trained in the Episcopal Church. That's the English version, right? A classically trained musician. She was an organist. And to some extent, she might have, you know, if they had ordained women in that church, she might have been a minister in that church, but they didn't. She got interested in Buddhism, and she met my Dharma great-grandfather, Kato Chisan, a Japanese Soto Zen priest and monk. She met him in London when he was traveling around on like a missionary tour. And he invited her at some point to go train with him in Japan. So she took him up on the offer, not realizing how actually incredibly unusual and challenging and difficult and awkward this offer actually was. Because, you know, she arrives in Japan. I mean, Sojiji is all men. It's all Japanese men. Like, these monasteries are not open to women. And no Westerners are training there either. I mean, this is a very strict and long tradition. So I can't imagine. I mean, Roshi Kennett was something of a character, but Kato Chisan saw something in her, and she trained. She actually wrote a book called The Wild White Goose about her experiences, which are, it's somewhat fictionalized, but it's very entertaining, interesting. So she ends up studying with Kato Chisan, having some significant breakthroughs and learns a lot, and she ends up going through the full empowerment ceremonies that previously women in Japan could only do in private. So in retrospect, she realizes that, we realize that Kato Chisan in some ways used her as a ramrod to open opportunities for women. Because some ways it was easier for him to do that with a Western woman than with a Japanese woman. So that's cool, part of our lineage. So, but once Kato Chisan died, things in Japan for Roshi Kennett became especially difficult, right? She's kind of being protected by her connection with, and he was the head of the Soto school for a number of years, so he's a high-ranking priest. So Roshi Kennett came to the U.S. and started teaching about 1967. And in 1970, she founded Shasta Abbey, a monastery which is still down in Shasta, California, in an old hotel. They got an old, not kind of motel, kind of campus thing. And in 1972, Gary Carlson, later Kyogen, enters Shasta and was ordained as a monk. And he practiced there for a number of years. And in 1975, my teacher, Andrea Krenke, later Gyokuko, enters Shasta and is also ordained. So they practice there for many years and complete their training and are empowered as priests. And in 1982, they got married with Roshi Kennett's blessing. And they were drawn to working with lay people, and Shasta has priories that are located all over the country. And so they came up to help lead the two Oregon priories, which were in Portland and Eugene. And there's still a Portland Buddhist priory. But then in 1986, they split from Shasta for various complicated reasons and founded Dharma Rain Zen Center. And so they founded this, you know, kind of independent from Shasta Abbey, because Shasta Abbey maintains this kind of administrative control over its priories. So this was an independent temple. And I arrived in 1995 there, and when you think about it, Dharmarine Zen Center wasn't much older than Brightway Zen is now, so it was still relatively small. And I did this calculation of like the Carlsons were only about 46, and I'm now 52. So it's kind of sweet to think of arriving at this community that these 40-somethings were. And that really, I mean, you think about it, then that means they started it when they were in their 30s. So if you ever find it, like some of the older folks in the Sangha, if you ever find it a little difficult to view me because of my age with full authority, like, you know, there's precedent for that. So Kyogen and Gyokoko were a team. So when I say I'm going to tell stories of my teachers, you know, it's like I can't tell stories of Kyogen without it also kind of applying to Gyokoko, which is kind of neat. Like you got one, you took one maybe formally as a teacher, but you really got both of them. And it established a model which is, you'll often see repeated at Zen centers where a couple actually runs the Zen center. And it's kind of in some ways it's an ideal situation because you get twice as much in terms of different ways of expression, different modes. Not to mention you have twice as many people to help with the work. So Kyogen mostly did admin and explicit teaching. He gave most of the talks and classes. Later on, seniors did a lot of that too. While Gyokoko anchored the community with meals and a calm and solid presence at the Zen Center. So very early on, they acquired a house where the Zen Center activities were and a couple people could live, including the Carlsons. So there was always a residential component to it, which is something I would love to have Brightway have someday. Anyway, so when I arrived, the Carlsons were still wearing robes that they made when they were at Shasta, and they were brown and like homemade. Like there's something, I think our lineage has gotten a little fancier. I don't know. But there's, from the very beginning, there's kind of this scruffiness to it, right? You think of this converted motel down in Shasta, you know, and like they wore these brown robes, and when they came up here, it was right at the time that all this stuff was going down with the Rajneeshis and stuff like that, so they were kind of trying to set themselves apart. But I just picture, you know, Kyogen was very tall and lanky, and, you know, he'd just be like striding across the street from the Dharma house to where the Zendo building was, in this, you know, big floppy brown robe, and he wore those, like, he said, like, Nike flip-flops. So, you know, Kyogen and Gyokoko presented the Dharma, created a temple, and they offered it all with really deep faith and conviction. So it was never about them. And they weren't dogmatic. So they deliberately named their temple Dharmarine, which comes from a story in the Lotus Sutra, where the Buddha tells a parable, and he says it's like the Dharma is like rain that falls equally on all beings. And, you know, they take up whatever they need. So over here we may have a little flower, over here we may have a tree, they just take up what they need. So that's the model that the Carlsons set up and that I've tried to continue, of just offering very freely. There's not a sense like, okay, well, here's the program. If you signed up for the program, are you really doing it? Like, you take what you need. If all you want to do is come to one talk a year, you are welcome. Like, your presence and your practice is honored. If you want to come every single time and, you know, help volunteer and all that, that's great too. But we try to avoid, you know, suggesting that, oh, you don't, you know, really belong. You're not really doing it. You're not a real Buddhist. So a very open and welcoming model. And you got a sense that they had a very, very clear idea about this lineage tradition, what it was, and they calmly created this practice container for us. So even when they innovated, you got a sense that they weren't making stuff up out of whole cloth. They were taking something from what they had received, and they were maybe finding a new way to offer it, or some way, like they created our term student program, because, you know, if you're going, you're living in a monastery with people, you get to know them, they get to know you, you butt up against each other, you, and all of this stuff happens, which if you're mostly a lay community, you often don't. You only see people for an hour or two a week, and it's a very, you know, kind of special circumstance, so you don't really get to know people. So they came up with this program to get to know people. So where Dharma Rain used to be, now it's up on 82nd Avenue. Where it used to be in the Hawthorne District, it had a big, beautiful craftsman house, and somehow, just like total chance, they were able to buy the church building directly across the street. So it was like a perfect setup. They had a residential house, they had a, you know, place, and we would sit morning and evening zazen throughout the week in the dining room of this house, which was just dedicated to being a zendo. So it had an altar and, you know, cushions set up and everything was all ready. So there's room for about 8 or 9 people in there. And we would sit there in the morning and evening, Wednesdays through Saturdays, do a chanting service in the morning and chanting in the evening. And Kyogen would, he'd be there for the morning. Gyokuko was doing exercises and stretches and stuff. And then in the evening, Gyokuko was there. Kyogen was not. So they shared that. And, you know, in the early days, I can remember Kyogen, you know, maybe there's only a couple of us there for morning chanting. And he would sit on the bowing mat, which is this thing, which sometimes in the cloud you can see in front of the altar. So he would be doing the doshi part, right, of like offering incense and being doing bows and being on the bowing mat. And he would just bring the instruments over, and he would do the instruments too. So like it was the whole, it was a one-man show. I mean, later on, some of us learned how to do various things, but you got a sense that like this morning chant, this morning zazen and chanting was gonna happen even if no one else was there. This was just something that happened. So they set up this really regular schedule of practice that we could drop into. And he had very precise ideas about how chanting should go. And you never got the sense that you had it quite on the mark. But he also really wasn't good at like sitting down with people and really mentoring them until they got it. You would just know that he was always just permanently a little dissatisfied. But, you know. So after morning chanting, Kyogen would make breakfast because he had oatmeal that he's very, very proud of. And during Sesshin, we will actually be eating this kind of oatmeal. So it's a very, like, I think he kind of came up with the recipe. Anyway, it's Bob's Red Mill extra thick rolled oats. And you cook it like, basically like rice. You get the water boiling, you put the oatmeal in there, and then you just let it sit and absorb the water. Because if you stir oatmeal, it gets pasty. So this is like, you know, the oats are soft, but they're nutty and whole. And anyway, so basically, a Dharma Rain, you have breakfast, I mean, I'm not sure that they do this anymore, but definitely during retreat, it was oatmeal every day. That's what you had, because then the next day, any leftover oats from the previous day can be incorporated. So that's what we're doing in Sesshin. We're gonna have those oats every day. And then our meal was silent until we were done eating, and then we'd hit the clappers, and then we'd have conversation. And sometimes in the early years when I was a resident there, so I was, I started staying there part-time when I was in graduate school, starting about 1997. And then around 2000, when I was done with my master's, I moved there full time. And so we'd often end up with meals, particularly lunches, where I was just sitting there with Kyogen and Gyokko in the kitchen. There was a kitchen table that had like three chairs. If you had more than that, you pulled the table out from the wall. If you had more than that, you set up a table in the living room, right? Like it was expandable and contractible. So I ate many meals just sitting there with Kyogen and Gyokko, my little like, you know, 20-something enthusiasm, being able to soak up the presence of these two teachers. And on Sundays, Kyogen would often ask us over breakfast what he should give the Dharma talk on, which was supposed to happen in a couple hours, right? And I always found that so amazing, but now that's what I do. I make it on Sunday mornings. I get up and I have my coffee and breakfast and I write this talk. I mean, you just do it, you do it and do it, and pretty soon it's not, you know, not all that hard. And his talks were very engaging. They often included mentions of something he heard on NPR, or Star Trek references, or other popular culture references. And the talks were always edifying, even though most of the time they kind of digressed and like, man, he's talking about this and he's talking about that and he's talking about that, but then he'd like bring it all back together at the end and you'd be like, all right, you know. And the thing is that so recently this book You Are Still Here came out, and my Dharma sister Jiko edited this, and from transcripts of his talks, and I don't think anybody realizes, like, I mean, she preserved the content, but that took a lot of work. That took a lot of work to take. I mean, if I look at a transcript of my talks, I go, oh my God, I don't want to see that in writing. It's terrible. So to take that from somebody who also tends to digress all over the place and make it coherent is a mighty task, but she did a beautiful job. One of the things that always struck me the most about him was just his deep sincerity and presence and compassion. And we would have Q&A sessions after he finished his talk, like we do. And you know, I mean, sometimes I get annoyed at the questions, right? Like somebody, and it's like, that's not even the topic that he was covering, or like, somebody kind of has an agenda and they're just kind of wanting to bring their agenda instead of really asking a question, or I don't know. But he would always he would find something to connect with the person over. He would find something in what they said, and in this very generous way, meet them. Proving it's not about the right answer, right? It's about actually meeting people where they are. So when I think about what I learned from my teachers, I mean, I couldn't finish the list, but from Gyokko, I got guidance on my own particular path, karma and awakening. And like I mentioned, that how to create a residential center, which isn't something I've really been, you know, doing, but will hopefully in the future. And from both of them, of course, ceremonies like we did today, the form of sesshin or meditation retreats, and certainly the Dharma. But from Kyogen, I learned how to run a Zen center. Admin, publicity, membership, databases, computers, schedules, websites, all the details which end up creating a container for practice. So he really, you know, he really had an entrepreneurial spirit, which is why Dharma Rain thrived the way it did. I mean, obviously you have to have the Dharma too. You have to have something really sincere and you have to have the Dharma, but he also had that. So I'm unfortunately blessed with some of those skills myself. So that those of us who were transmitted as teachers, I like to think if you dropped us on a desert island, we could recreate our tradition. All, more or less all aspects of it. Maybe we'd forget some details, but all of the essentials would be there. And this, like I said, is through an apprenticeship model. So, like I said, I have a terrible narrative memory, and I remember how I felt, but not the details. So I just wanted to read a description of Kyogen by Jiko in this book, You Are Still Here. So she says, the relationship, so Kyogen was her teacher for over 30 years before he passed away in 2014. She says, the relationship between a good teacher and a devoted student is unlike any other. When that relationship takes place in a religious context, it creates a peculiar space in which we are forced to examine and question everything we believe ourselves to be. Every opinion, value, and belief is exposed. If it works, those archetypal roles bring two people together in an unparalleled intimacy. Kyogen sometimes reminded me that he was holding up a mirror to me, that everything I saw in him was a reflection. He often spoke of the relationship between a flawed human being and a perfect Buddha. You see a human being, he would say, and suddenly a Buddha steps forward. Done well in the teacher-student relationship, we are giving ourselves to the reflection, seeking our own perfect nature in relationship with another. The danger is in believing that the reflection is reality, but the reflection must be absorbed. Disappointment inevitably follows such devotion, because in the next moment, the human being steps out of the Buddha. The beloved teacher, the guide, the giver, the leader is suddenly nothing more than an ordinary, imperfect, annoying human being. And human Kyogen most certainly was. He could race a go-kart and then explain a fine point in Dogen's Shobogenzo. He was a runner with bad knees, competitive by nature, and liked to tend a barbecue at potlucks. He got migraine headaches. He was inquisitive and loved gadgets of all kinds. He would interrupt a spiritual interview to show his guest something on his computer. He had a goofy sense of humor, a scholar's memory of Buddhist scripture, and a nerd's love of science. Kyogen loved to travel, loved to watch sports, loved to read. He did not like being fussed over. He had a fine tenor voice. He was often late and usually denied this. So it goes, back and forth, human and Buddha, reflection and reality. I am grateful beyond words that I had so many years in which to swing on this particular seesaw between his attention and his dismissal, casual encounters and formal meetings, institutional rank and love. So I meant to start my whole talk with the warning that I might cry. I wouldn't even warn, and it wouldn't bother me at all, except that it's really difficult to talk when you're crying. I've come to, it's like when we love someone, especially if they're a major part of our life, they literally become part of who we are. And so when we lose them, we feel emotional pain and disorientation the same way as if part of our body was removed. We'd feel physical pain and disorientation, right? Like part of us is gone, is lost, is removed. And so there's always, and I find, and some of us find, that like, it's very easy to be moved to that edge of this, the enormity of love and gratitude and grief and wonder and awe. Like like it doesn't take too much in terms of words or music or anything to put us right there, which in some ways is a gift and in some ways can be annoying. But anyway, let's see, where are we? So just a few of the things that I picked up from Kyogen and by extension Gyokoku. And I'm just gonna briefly go over these because then I have, I would like somebody to read a very short, like one page essay that I wrote in March 2015, just a few months after Kyogen died. There's no way I can get through that. So I figure I'll have somebody in the cloud read it out loud for me, who's not easily moved to tears. Just in the meantime, I guess, so that somebody can get that up, do I have a volunteer for that in the cloud? Somebody who has on a computer and you can pull it up? All right, Jinryu, aren't you gonna cry too?
I think I can manage.
All right.
If you prefer someone else, that's fine.
No. So let me just get that document up and share it so that. And I guess I'm gonna. Probably be best if I gave you a link, and then you could open it up just for yourself.
Where are you putting the link?
I will chat you directly. All right, just to you. Okay. And let me know, Jinryu, if you have any problems pulling that up. I will go on with my list here. So these are some things I learned and flavors I picked up from Kyogen, and they're not exclusives. It's not like, oh, other Zen centers wouldn't have this, but the first, you know, is an emphasis on Zazen, Sesshin, and the possibility of awakening. But also a very masterful balance between emphasizing that and also emphasizing, yeah, and 99% of the time you're living your life off the cushion, right? And it's where you can practice every moment, and that how you manifest this in your everyday life is just as important. So by extension, Kyogen and Gyokoku, but Kyogen in particular, was a passionate advocate for lay practice, for what he called being ordained into your life. So there's a lot of traditional Zen practices, like being in a monastery, being ordained, going to meditation retreats, things like that, which may be less accessible to certain people, or maybe something that people don't even want to do. But he would emphasize, you don't need to do that. What you need to do is be wholly present in your life. So it was always like the lay path, which kind of by definition means every one of you has a different path. You have a different life. You have different karma. You have different families. You have different jobs. Like every one of you has your own path, which is just as rich and full as any kind of formal Zen path. So he was very passionate about that, and that's why in our lineage we have a number of fully empowered lay teachers. So they were not ordained like I was. They did not spend time in a residential community like I did, but they can give precepts, they can have students, they can transmit what they learned, all of that. I think he also was he had a very, very flexible mind. So he was he demonstrated, you know, what you might call tolerance for ambiguity, and or just, I don't know, most of us kind of get stuck in a particular view, you know, and we could approach him with this view, and he would just He just had a masterful way of saying kind of and and just, not challenging, like he was attacking you or anything, but just and, so that you kind of went, oh, okay, wow. And a great example of this was he had a long friendship with a local evangelical Christian. And this Paul Metzger, this evangelical Christian, taught at Nova Bible College. I think it has a different name now, but anyway. And he and Kyogen, somehow they met at some interfaith thing and hit it off. And we're talking evangelical, we're talking conservative. We're talking you are going to hell if you are gay. And somehow Kyogen and Paul had conversations, respectful conversations, and they even arranged interfaith dialogues with groups of us from the different communities. So we'd have a potluck, like we'd go to the Mount Nova Bible College, a bunch of us Buddhists, some of whom were explicitly gay, and we would have a respectful dialogue with these folks. And Paul and Kyogen, I think, both realized, even though they did not see the world the same way, but they understood that respect and, that kind of connection, that's where healing for individuals and for our culture has to come from. So they really modeled that. And there's actually, this is self-published by Paul Metzger, but he wrote a book called Evangelical Zen. And because he has a Japanese wife and he spent time in Japan. So these are different reflections of like his journey and his experience of Japan. And then with each chapter, he had Kyogen respond. Like Kyogen just kind of mused or filled in or responded to whatever Paul had written in the chapter. So it's a very sweet book. So, and he also really emphasized the importance of Dharma Rain, our lineage, staying connected with the larger Soto Zen world, which is kind of a work in progress. Soto Zen's been here for, well, 60 years in terms of like the convert communities, but much longer than that in terms of the heritage Buddhist communities. And everybody just, it's like a bunch of mavericks. You just, you got translated by your teacher, you ran off, you started a Zen center, you did things your way. And like, there's no overarching, like there is in Japan, there's definitely like the Catholic Church. It's like there's an overarching organization and there are ways things are done and kind of you know what you're getting, for better or for worse, right? In the US, it's just kind of each, this is the way we love to do stuff, right? We're just individualistic. Don't tell me what to do. I'm just going to go off and start my own Zen center. But that has its own problems, right? Because then when you're not connected, you have no peers to hold you accountable, things can really go off the rails. So anyway, for many reasons, he's one of the central people who revitalized the AZTA, American Zen Teachers Association, and the SZBA, the Soto Zen Buddhist Association. He was president for a couple of terms, and when he was president, I became the first associate member of the board, meaning I wasn't a transmitted priest yet, I wasn't a full member of the SZBA, but they felt it was important to have somebody like that on the board. So I was the first person to do that, and then after that, I moved into being the coordinator of the SZBA, like the admin person. Which is, in some ways, is like how I know so many and how many Zen folks know of me. It's because I emailed them about their membership or about their session registration or something like that. So, and I think, I was going to school to become a wildlife biologist when I got involved, heavily involved in Zen. And for various reasons, I became somewhat disillusioned with the path of a wildlife biologist. And at the same time, I saw, if you had to ask me at that time, look around you and that's what people are doing and who is making the biggest difference. And it looked to me like my teachers are making the biggest difference. I mean, maybe not in a like a political or societal sense, but I saw the difference they were making in people's lives and in my life. And I'm like, well, I think I'm gonna go on this path. Jinryu, are you ready to read that little?
I am, and there's one little typo that I can't figure out. It says I junior priest training in 20.
That would be 2010.
2010. Okay, so here it goes. At my Zen center last Sunday, we read.
Hold on one. I wrote this in March of 2015. Just context. Go ahead.
At my Zen center last Sunday, we read and discussed a beautiful teaching from Kyogen Carlson, one of my Zen teachers. It was from the chapter Dharma Realm in a little booklet Kyogen called Zen Roots. It called this excerpt Kyogen Carlson on the Cosmic Buddha. We lost Kyogen suddenly last September to a heart attack, and rediscovering this teaching from him made me miss him terribly. It isn't so much that I miss him personally, in the sense of regular interactions, although he was generally a fun and interesting person to be around. Since I completed my junior priest training in 2010, I had not seen Kyogen that often. So I can't claim to be one of the many people directly impacted by his absence on a daily basis. What I felt profoundly this last weekend was a longing for his dharma. This dharma includes his teaching or his unique way of understanding and expressing Buddhism, Zen, and practice. However, that's only part of it. Because I had that aspect of his dharma when I was holding his written teaching in my hands. The part that was missing was his living testimonial to the truth and reality of those teachings, his posture, his eyes, his physical expression that grounded the teaching in front of you in a provocative, encouraging, and indisputable way. Anyone can write or speak teachings that sound pretty good. They may resonate with us, challenge us, or inspire us. But just because they sound good doesn't mean they are true or effective. And just because we like them doesn't mean we understand them. And then sometimes we don't like teachings and we want to avoid them. Then we encounter a true teacher like Kyogen, someone who verified for himself through direct experience, what he taught, and someone who had achieved the spiritual maturity to abide peacefully in his understanding without needing to convince or convert others in an effort to feel more secure. Such a teacher gives you the opportunity to experience a full embodied encounter with that which you do not yet know. Kyogen Carlson on the Cosmic Buddha is his take on the Zen encounter with what Houston Smith calls the more, and what Kyogen's teacher Roshi Kenet called the Lord of the House. Vaguely theistic imagery is often troubling to Zen students, and when I first encountered it in Zen, I was strongly ambivalent. On the one hand, I was intrigued by the idea of having some kind of transcendent experience. But on the other, I was worried that this woo-woo stuff was a sign Zen was going to prove itself to be based on BS in the long run. I went to Kyogen with my ambivalence, hoping he would tell me to ignore all of the references to the Lord of the House and the Cosmic Buddha in Roshi Kenet's writings because they were irrelevant to Zen practice. He didn't. He compassionately tried to explain the presence of devotion and theistic imagery in Zen, as he does so well in his essay. But he didn't back down. There he sat, a thoughtful but slightly wry expression on his face, a concrete testimony to a reality I had not yet experienced. There is much more I don't understand, and much more Kyogen could have taught me just by living his truth.
Right. Well,
She almost got me.
any comments or questions? Didn't leave a lot of time, but there's a few minutes. Judith.
I'm down to one hearing aid, so just ignore me here. I'm not sure about the time period, but I was not involved in any Buddhist community when my mother died here. She was in a nursing home. And she's not a Christian, and I had had a loose affiliation with San Francisco Zen Center. So I decided that the best thing to do with her cremated remains was to be blessed by a Soto Zen priest. So that is how I came to interact with Dogen, and I mean with Carlson. Anyway, he was. I was leery because I
So
had.
you brought your mom's ashes to Kyogen.
Yes. And I gave him money. I didn't know how to do this, but they looked like they needed money. And I was working for a law firm, so I thought, okay, I gave him either somewhere between $300 and $500. Please perform a ceremony. And he brought me up to the residence, to his office, and I sat there with him, and he kept me there for like 2.5 hours. Well, he wanted to know what was my connection to Zen, so of course he wanted the gossip from San Francisco Zen Center, right? Which I was willing to give him, but I was a little suspicious of him because the males at San Francisco Zen were usually the source of trouble. And he was a male. But anyway, he just seemed like a kid and a great kid. I mean, I had no bad vibes from him at all. So I sat there with him, and of course, half of the time was devoted to him showing me his website. So I just want you to know. And then when we got to the actual arranged schedule ceremony, which I wonder if you were in, we were at the main hall in the building, and it was in the evening. My mother's ashes were up, and I brought a picture of her, and then there were monks, I don't know who they're, in robes, sitting, three or four on either side, some drums. And there were a few of us. I mean, my mother had no friends, so there were my friends in the audience. The audience was small. And they started chanting. And at one, it, the chanting sounded a little off. He stopped the whole ceremony and made them repeat it. And he was obviously annoyed with the way they were doing things.
See, this is the kind of story I wish that I could retain. This is exactly the
So
kind of
you weren't
story.
there.
Well, what year was it?
I'm going to have to figure that out. But it was somewhere after 2010. So maybe you had moved
I
on
think I had
since.
already moved, yeah.
Okay. It was hysterical. A little, but I was used to this sort of Zen setting, and my friends didn't know what to make of it. And then afterwards, he and his wife had us down in the basement for tea, and they were absolutely charming, charming. Anyway,
thank you so much. Thank you for sharing. Bruce.
Romeo, thank you so much for sharing this personal story. I think it took some courage on your part to relive this, based on the fact that you could not read that essay yourself. And I felt that pain even when Jane, you had a hard time with those passages that I wish I had known. And got that book, so I think that's what I'll take to Sesshin next week. So I'm looking forward to seeing everybody there. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you know, nobody, anytime you lose anyone, you know, I mean, you never think like, yeah, they might as well gone, you know, like, you know, you're always like sad that they didn't live longer and whatever, but it just, you know, I think everybody who knew Kyogen just agreed, like, oh my God, he had another 20 years of like just getting more brilliant, you know, and there's just many times when I stop and think, like, you know, I'm thinking about some aspect of the Dharma or teaching or something, and I'm like, I wish I could go ask Kyogen about this, right? And it's because of that way he had of just like, just be a different perspective. You'd usually be surprised at his answer. You think you could kind of anticipate his answer, but you couldn't. But I did want to say, let's see if I can say this without crying, but despite the fact that he passed away very, very suddenly, I mean, just aided chanting service, he was walking back to the nearby house, had a heart attack, was dead by the time they got him to the hospital. And so, like, I can't remember what hospital it was, but they really accommodated us, and he was able to be in a room, and like any of us could visit all day long. They let us basically have a whole like wing of this hospital ward, and so there were people crying in the hallways and going in to spend time with the body, and they did the ceremonies that we do around the body. And even though there was this great sense of loss and this great sense of this shouldn't have happened, I was struck by, like, this just felt that there's no leftover karma here. Just no, like, he left something unfinished, or there were hard feelings, or any of the kind of sticky, unresolved stuff that we tend to, you know, most of us leave behind, right? I kind of wish this, I kind of wish that, whatever. It just felt so, just so clean, like he lived completely, and if he could speak from wherever he is, he would just been like, damn, that was a surprise, you know, and no great angst. So I think, wow, that's something to aspire to, you know. I hope that similarly, if and when I go, it's just like, well, that's too bad, but it's complete. Jinri.
I'll be 1 minute. I do have a bad cough today, which you might have heard some of that in my voice. But I made it all the way through the end until I read the last sentence. And there is so much more I don't understand, and much more Kyogen could have taught me just by living his truth. And when he died, I had only been at Brightway for a year, maybe, but you had talked about him with such fondness that I thought I really needed to meet this guy. And that was part of the reason why I joined that Christian Buddhist group, because I thought Kyogen would come someday. And I never did get a chance. And I am sad that I never got a chance to meet him. So what I would say is to all the people here, he's one of our ancestors. Chosen, Hogan, Eudaimio, all of these people whose teachings we revere so much. They're all getting older, not so much you, but a lot of them are getting really quite a bit old. And we should pursue them. We should get to know them, meet them, just have, sit down and have a sanzen with them once during a retreat. It's just so important. That's it.
Thank you. Yeah, and this book is an absolute treasure for our lineage. You know, this really does give you a wonderful sense of flavor of him. And I heard that, I think around Founders Day maybe, because you know the Dharmarine does Founders Day as well. And I believe that they listened to a recorded Dharma talk of his, which I think that might be a really fun thing to do sometime because you do, you know, there's no visuals, but you really do get a sense of somebody from there, from the way they talk. So, well, thank you all for being here. We abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. The mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Oh, and I forgot, Ryan met Kyogen. Ryan was in our Dharma school. Maybe you could share a story someday.
Lucky you, Ryan.
Oh yeah. Shoketsu has something to say if anybody wants to stick around.
When I first started going to Buddhist community at Dharmarain. I lived on the west side, but I came all the way into Hawthorne and practiced, so I was fortunate to have met him.
Oh.
And I think I met you too when you were, maybe it was before you even started the other one, the west side Zen. And then I was able to come. I found that and it was just
Yeah.
changed my life. But I do, I'm pleased that I got to know him some.
Me too. Oh yes, and then So-on, who's
Yes.
sometimes part of our
Right.
she was one of his formal students too. So we have some living connections to him.